Jane and I are grateful for the hospitality of the wonderful staff of this chapel and the hospitality of this congregation over during our time in Boston. You do Bob Hill proud. Please allow us to return the favor. Visit us at Foundry Church when you are in Washington, D.C. Our theme this summer is Faith in Darwin. Our topic this morning is the limits of our exceptionalism. There are those who believe that religions can be understood sociologically, anthropologically, except for Christianity. Other religions are humanity's search for God, while Christianity is God's search for humanity. This way of thinking could be called Christian exceptionalism. Religions are human endeavors, except for mine. If one nation consumes significantly more than the rest of the world and has a foreign policy based on keeping its citizens' desire to consume sated, and if this nation uses its military to police its foreign policy, this nation would usually be called an empire. If we say that nations that become empires are inevitably oppressive of others, except for my nation, because my nation, unlike other nations, is good and well-intentioned, this would be called nationalistic exceptionalism. A Boston University professor named Andrew J. Bacevich has written what is surely one of the most important books of our decade. A retired colonel, a student of the writing of Reinhold Niebuhr, a long-term opponent of the war in Iraq, the father of a soldier who gave his life in Iraq. His book is entitled The Limits of Power. It is subtitled The End of American Exceptionalism. Galtism, the idea that the rich are rich because they are superior to the poor, this is an exceptionalist way of thinking. There are lots of examples. One of the reasons Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species was so shocking at the time that it was published 150 years ago, and one of the reasons that it continues to be at the center of the cultural wars of our time, is that Darwin's theories challenge and undermine pretty much every expression of exceptionalism. Darwin discovered in his study of nature a radical egalitarianism. Life has evolved the way it has, not because some forms of life were especially ordained or superior, but simply because the organisms that are best adapted to their environment tend to produce more offspring, while those less well suited tend to diminish. You know, the phrase, the survival of the fittest, does not mean the survival of those who go to the gym the most. It means the survival of those who happen to fit best within the environment in which they find themselves. It could just as well be called the survival of the luckiest, the survival of those species that find themselves in the time and place that happen to fit them best. Not divine selection, not moral selection, not even intelligent selection. I've known some folk who were exceedingly intelligent who have not tended to produce more offspring. Watch an episode of the TV show The Big Bang sometime. Not selection by any merit, but natural selection. Eugenie Scott, the executive director of the National Center for Science Education, says, Darwin's theory challenged the notions of human exceptionalism and brought to light this idea that humans are a result of natural processes, meaning we are not as special as we once thought. Well, what do we think about this, those of us who read poetry and pray and sing hymns and listen to sermons? Well, clearly we human beings are special. It wasn't raccoons that built this beautiful chapel. It wasn't chipmunks who wrote the music that we heard the choir sing this morning. Of course, we are special, just maybe not as special as we once thought we were. Whatever else we are, we're animals too. We need to eat. I traveled in Africa some with a bishop I used to work with who had visited Africa many, many times. I asked him once why he thought a certain African nation kept electing an obviously corrupt president. He said that when you have experienced starvation, you will elect anyone you think will feed you. And this is not that different, is it, from the "it's the economy, stupid" election campaigns here in the U.S. We have to eat. We don't have to be enslaved by our appetites, but we usually get in trouble if we try to deny they exist. I know eating disorders are a complicated thing, and I don't want to treat their causes in a trivial way. But the Jungian therapist Marion Woodman, who was anorexic as a young woman, Marion Woodman believes that one of the things that food disorders and their prevalence in our society symbolizes is a desire on our part not to be bound to the earth, not to be dirty, not to make dirt, not to be human. The prevalence of food disorders symbolizes a desire to be more than human, to be angels, to be gods. She calls it an addiction to perfection. We don't have to be enslaved by our appetites, but as my mother used to say, you've got to eat. I knew an exceptional person years ago who starved himself to death as a protest against homelessness in America. I never want to see such an exceptional thing happen again. Whatever else we are animals too. And part of it is that we are sexual. We don't need to be slaves to our sexual drives and feelings, but it's generally not a very good idea to pretend they don't exist. You know who was very practical and down to earth about this? Some of you will be surprised. The Apostle Paul. I'm not kidding. Apparently, for some of his life, Paul was celibate. And he writes in one of his letters that he wishes all Christians could be like him in this way so that they could focus all of their time and energies on ministry. But then he adds this proviso. However, he says, it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion. It is not a good idea to pretend that you are not sexual. It is better to find healthy ways of expressing our sexuality. It seems to me a pretty enlightened way of thinking for the times, admittedly Victoria in a guy sort of way, but still. I think if Paul knew what we know today, he would agree with Massachusetts and Connecticut and Idaho. It is not a good idea to expect human beings not to be sexual. Whatever else we are animals too, we are sexual, and we are subject to the vicissitudes of earthly existence. We have not figured out yet how to do away with disease and death. I miss Sue Zabel. Sue was an ordained clergy person and a seminary professor, but she plunged into congregational life the way any rank and file Christian would. Sue even took a turn at chairing our finance committee. You know how rare it is to find a seminary professor who'd be willing to chair a local church finance committee or capable? Sue got cancer and too soon died. You know the scripture that she used to quote to me the most as she was fighting her cancer? She quoted the words of Jesus saying that God makes God's sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Cancer happens, disease happens, death happens. We can study disease and try to eradicate it, and we should. But apparently God or nature does not accept us from natural disasters, disease, physical anomalies, congenital disorders, or any of the rest of it. Apparently God or nature does not dole out diseases to those who deserve them or grant good health to those who deserve that. We are not accepted. A friend sent me this week a photo of someone's great-grandmother sitting in front of a birthday cake with three candles on the cake. The candles are in the shapes of the letters 100, spelling out 100. In the picture, she is leaning forward toward the cake, using the flame of the second candle to light her cigarette. Go figure. I love listening to your choir on your podcast, but on the treadmill at the gym, I sometimes listen to a British guitar player and songwriter named Mark Knopfler. I like him because his lyrics are often a combination of profundity and just plain fun. He wrote these lyrics: "Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes it all comes together, baby, sometimes you're a fool in love. Sometimes you're the Louisville slugger, sometimes you're the ball. Sometimes it all comes together, baby. Sometimes you're going to lose it all." Apparently, God doesn't make the sun shine on the good or grant them health and wealth and advanced degrees. Nor does God make it rain or send trouble and hardship to only the unrighteous. Apparently, God doesn't make an exception for you or me. So where is God in all of this, in natural selection, in evolution? That is, of course, too big a question to answer in one sermon, but I think there are a couple of hints in the book of Hebrews as to where God might be in the midst of natural selection and evolution. I turn to the book of Hebrews because it asks the question, what is man, what is woman, what is a human being? But I found there some hints to the answer to the questions, to the question of where God is. The book of Hebrews says, and I think this is absolutely delightful, the book of Hebrews says, "Now God did not subject the coming world about which we are speaking to angels." God did not subject the coming world of which we are speaking to angels. And then later, talking about Jesus, Hebrews says, "It is clear he did not come to help angels, but the descendants of Abraham." Whatever God is doing in the universe, it's not in the angelic realms of elevated and lofty sentiments and nobility. It's not in the rarefied purity of heavenly places. It is in the world where whatever else we are animals and we are sexual, and where we are sometimes healthy and full of life, and where we sometimes get sick and die. No exceptions. This world, the world of windshields and bugs and Louisville sluggers and balls. Warren Zevon was another songwriter. His lyrics, too, were often smart and funny. For much of his life, he abused substances severely, and then later in life found sobriety, and then was diagnosed with a particularly virulent form of cancer. He knew he was dying. He agreed to go on the David Letterman show. It was an amazing interview. Zeeland talked with Letterman openly and with a sense of humor about his impending death. At one point in the interview, Letterman asked Zeeland, "Is there anything you know from the place you are at now that I might not know that you could tell me?" In other words, at the edge of death, is there any knowledge that you have discovered that you can share with me who will someday be where you are now? Zeeland said, "Not really. The only advice I can give you is enjoy every sandwich. Where is God in the world of natural selection and evolution? I think God is in the sandwich. Isn't this what we Christians say we believe, that God is in the bread and the wine? God is in the sandwich." Every 4 years, Methodists elect delegates to national and regional conferences where they pass the rules of the church and elect bishops. Back in Washington, D.C., there's a very funny resolution that some people wrote that we will be voting on next year. The resolution says that Methodist clergy shall not campaign to be elected as delegates to general or jurisdictional conferences, neither shall they campaign to be elected as bishops. This is a very funny resolution. Passing a law that Methodist clergy should not jockey for position and power and prestige within the church is like passing a law that hound dogs should not sniff nor monkeys scratch. I think that God is somewhere in the midst of grubby church politics. God is in the midst of the fervent departmental wars in this university. God is in the midst of the wheeling and dealing in the halls of Congress. Whatever God is doing in our world, God isn't doing it in the realm of the lofty and angelic. God is doing it in the world where we eat and mate and practice politics. God is in the bread and the wine, and we ought to taste every bite, laugh at everything that's funny, cry about all of the sadness. God is in the sandwich. You notice in our gospel lesson this morning that when Jesus invites his disciples to go with him to a deserted place, by the time he gets there, the crowds have already found him. And it turns out that God is in the people milling around him and trying to touch the hem of his garment. God is in the midst of life in this world. The other hint I see in Hebrews is that God is somewhere in the rules to which we are subjected. Not the rules we make, but the rules we can't do anything about. The rules with no exceptions. God is somewhere in the rule that when the humidity in the air reaches a certain point at a certain temperature, it's going to rain on us, whether we are righteous or unrighteous. God is somewhere in the rule that determines the sun is going to set at 8:16 p.m. tonight in Boston, whether we are good or bad the rest of the day today. Test it if you will. Be as good or as bad as you can be today, and the sun will still set at 8:16 p.m. in Boston tonight. No matter whether we are righteous or unrighteous during the night tonight, the sun is going to rise at 5:26 a.m. in Boston tomorrow morning. No exceptions. God is somewhere within the rules to which we are subjected. The rule that none of us gets out of here alive, the rule that a sperm and an egg will meet and seed new life, the rule of the survival of the luckiest. God is somewhere in the rule that we more or less reap what we sow, the rule that you can't fool all of the people all of the time, Malcolm X's rule that chickens come home to roost, Dr. King's rule that truth crushed to the ground will rise again. God is in the sandwich, and God is somewhere in the rules to which we are subjected. 8 years before he completed The Origin of the Species, the year was 1851, Charles Darwin's 10-year-old daughter, Annie, the light of his life, died. It was for him a massive grief. After her death, Darwin concentrated even more on his work. He plunged into it to almost the exclusion of everything else, and maybe he was just compensating for his pain. But something else may have been at work in him too. It may be that when our world has fallen apart, the rules of the universe can feel to us like everlasting arms. We find God in the sandwich, and we find God somewhere in the rules that we can neither make nor change. No exceptions.